A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, picking up a thread we've been pulling at. The progressive charge that conservatism locks in problems, that wanting to preserve what exists is inherently destructive because it prevents progress. His question is, how do conservatives actually create space for innovation and advancement? What does progress look like through a conservative lens? And he's right. This gets at the core division. The progressive framework assumes it has a monopoly on the very idea of progress, and that's a claim worth examining.
It's a claim that's been allowed to sit largely unchallenged in public discourse for decades. The assumption is, if you're conservative, you're the brake pedal, and if you're progressive, you're the accelerator. But that metaphor already concedes too much. Conservatives don't think they're braking, they think they're steering.
Which is a much more interesting argument. Because the progressive charge isn't subtle. It says conserving is just hoarding problems, that the status quo is always a collection of injustices waiting to be disrupted. And if that's the only frame, then conservatives are just the people who like the injustices.
And that frame works because it flattens conservatism into a cartoon. But if you actually read the thinkers who built the tradition, they've been theorizing change for centuries. They just don't theorize it the same way. So let's start with the big one. Edmund Burke, 1790, Reflections on the Revolution in France. He's watching the French revolutionaries tear down every institution, the monarchy, the church, the aristocracy, the courts, and replace them with abstractions. The rights of man, the general will. And he writes this line that I think is the foundational conservative statement on change. A state without the means of some change is without the means of its conservation.
That's a remarkable sentence, actually. It's almost paradoxical. The way to conserve something is to change it.
It's not a contradiction. It's a description of how living things actually work. A forest that never changes is a dead forest. An institution that can't adapt gets swept away by the first crisis it faces. Burke's argument was that the British Constitution had survived because it knew how to reform itself in small, careful increments, whereas the French Ancien Régime had become brittle precisely because it resisted all change until it shattered.
The conservative move isn't never change. It's never change everything at once on the basis of a theory.
That's it. And Burke was writing in response to a specific disaster. The revolutionaries had this beautiful abstract plan for a rational society, and within a few years it had become the terror. The guillotine, the Committee of Public Safety, mass drownings in the Loire. Burke's point wasn't that the old regime was wonderful, he'd criticized it plenty. His point was that the revolutionaries had thrown away centuries of accumulated knowledge about how to run a society, and they replaced it with nothing but their own confidence.
That confidence is the thing conservatives keep coming back to. The hubris of believing you can redesign a complex system from first principles. Hayek called it the fatal conceit.
Which brings us to Hayek. Let's set up the mechanism. Because Burke gives us the disposition, change cautiously, preserve what works, but Hayek gives us the actual machinery. His 1945 essay, The Use of Knowledge in Society, is one of those rare pieces of writing that changes how you see everything.
Walk us through it.
Hayek's question is deceptively simple. How does a society coordinate the knowledge of millions of people who don't know each other and will never meet? Every individual has local, specific, often tacit knowledge. The farmer knows when his field is ready to plant. The factory manager knows which supplier is suddenly unreliable. The shopkeeper knows what her customers are suddenly buying less of. No central planner can gather all that information. It's too dispersed, too fleeting, too contextual.
This is where the price system comes in.
The price system is the discovery procedure. When tin becomes scarce, the price rises. That single number tells everyone, instantly, tin is more valuable now, use less of it, find alternatives. Nobody needs to know why tin is scarce. Nobody needs a memo from the Ministry of Tin. The price does all the coordination work, and it does it faster and more accurately than any central authority ever could.
Let me push on that, because I can hear the objection already. Someone listening is thinking, sure, prices work for tin, but what about things that don't have prices? What about clean air, or a stable climate, or social cohesion? Doesn't the price system just ignore those because they're not commodities?
That's a legitimate challenge, and Hayek himself would acknowledge it. The price system only discovers what can be priced. For everything else, you need other discovery mechanisms, social norms, cultural traditions, legal precedents. And this is actually where the conservative framework gets richer, because conservatives argue that many of our non-price institutions are themselves discovery procedures. The common law evolves through cases, not through legislative blueprints. Social norms evolve through millions of tiny interactions, not through centralized campaigns. The mechanism is different, but the logic is the same. Dispersed local knowledge, incremental adjustment, emergent order.
Innovation in a Hayekian framework isn't something you plan. It's something that emerges from millions of people responding to local signals and experimenting with solutions.
And this is where the conservative theory of innovation gets its distinctive shape. Progressives tend to see innovation as something you direct. You set a goal, you fund the research, you pick the winners. Conservatives see innovation as something you enable. You create the conditions where people can experiment, and you let the successful experiments spread through a competitive process.
Discovery versus design.
That's the distinction, and it runs all the way through the tradition. Discovery innovation is bottom-up, incremental, tested by experience. Design innovation is top-down, comprehensive, tested only against the logic of the blueprint. Conservatives don't oppose innovation. They oppose the hubris of design.
Which is where Oakeshott comes in. Michael Oakeshott, Rationalism in Politics, 1962. He gives us this wonderful concept, intimation. Change as the pursuit of intimations.
It's a beautiful word for it. Oakeshott's metaphor is a ship at sea. You're not sailing toward a predetermined destination. There's no port on the map that you're trying to reach. You're keeping the ship seaworthy, making adjustments as the weather changes, responding to what the sea and the ship are telling you. That's intimation. You're not imposing a plan on reality. You're reading the signals reality is already sending.
The rationalist, in Oakeshott's telling, finds this intolerable. The rationalist wants to know the destination, wants a blueprint, wants to rebuild the ship from the keel up according to sound engineering principles, while it's still at sea in a storm with everyone aboard.
That's not a caricature of progressive ambition. That's a description of what actually happens when you try to redesign complex systems from scratch. The Soviet Union is the canonical example. Central planners had enormous technical expertise, vast resources, and genuinely ambitious goals. And they failed, catastrophically, because they couldn't access the local knowledge that Hayek described. Without price signals, they couldn't discover what was needed where. A Soviet factory manager would receive a production target in tons of steel, so he'd make the heaviest, clunkiest steel products possible, because that's what the metric rewarded. Nobody could correct that from the center, because nobody at the center knew it was happening.
It's almost a perfect case study of what happens when you ignore intimation. The planners had a destination, full communism, industrial modernity, and they steered directly toward it while ignoring every signal the ship was sending them. Shortages, bottlenecks, black markets, all screaming that the plan wasn't working, and they just kept adjusting the plan rather than questioning whether planning itself was the problem.
And the black market is actually the tragic proof of Hayek's point. It was the only part of the Soviet economy where prices could do their discovery work, and it was illegal. Citizens were risking prison to participate in the only functional information system the economy had.
Whereas the Industrial Revolution, which we think of as this great explosion of innovation, wasn't designed by anyone. It was piecemeal tinkering. 1,000 small improvements in loom design and steam pressure and metallurgy. Each one building on the last. Nobody coordinating it. Nobody planning it.
The spinning jenny wasn't a government moonshot. Neither was the steam engine. James Watt was repairing a Newcomen engine at the University of Glasgow and thought, I can make this more efficient. That's discovery innovation. That's intimation. He was responding to a specific problem in front of him, not executing a grand theory of industrialization.
Here's a fun fact that I think illustrates this perfectly. The Newcomen engine that Watt was repairing had itself been invented half a century earlier, not by an engineer, but by an ironmonger and a Baptist lay preacher who were trying to pump water out of tin mines. They weren't trying to launch the Industrial Revolution. They had a flooded mine, and they needed a solution. The whole thing is just one local problem after another, each solution enabling the next problem to become visible.
That's the chain of intimation and action. You solve the problem in front of you, and the solution reveals the next problem. You don't need to see the whole path from the beginning. You just need to be paying attention.
Let's bring in Russell Kirk, because he crystallizes this in a way that's useful. Kirk's 10 conservative principles. Principle 7 is, change is not reform. What's the distinction?
Kirk argued that reform is change that conserves. It addresses a genuine problem within the existing framework, and it makes the whole system more durable. Change, that's just change. Change for the sake of change. Change driven by ideology or boredom or the desire to smash something. That's not reform. That's destruction. Kirk put it directly. The conservative is a reformer who wants to reform in order to conserve.
The test is whether the change strengthens or weakens the thing it's changing.
Whether it respects the knowledge embedded in the existing system. Kirk had this almost ecological view of institutions. A constitution, a legal tradition, a set of social norms. These things embody the accumulated experience of generations. They're not just arbitrary rules that someone made up. They're solutions to problems that people have already encountered and solved, often at great cost. When you sweep them away, you're not starting from zero. You're starting from negative knowledge. You're throwing away solutions you don't even know you had.
This is the Chesterton's fence principle, essentially. Don't tear down a fence until you understand why someone built it in the first place.
And the progressive retort would be, fine, but what if the fence is keeping people out of land they have a right to access? What if the fence is unjust? And the conservative answer isn't tough luck, the fence stays. It's understand the fence before you remove it, because there might be a reason it's there that you haven't considered, and if you just rip it out, you might cause harm you didn't anticipate.
Let me give a concrete example of Chesterton's fence that I think makes this visceral. In the 1980s and 90s, a lot of development economists looked at traditional pastoralist societies in East Africa and thought, these people are inefficient. They move their cattle constantly instead of settling down and ranching properly. Let's help them modernize. So they encouraged settlement, built permanent water points, introduced fixed grazing boundaries. And within a few years, huge swaths of land had become desert. What they didn't understand was that the constant movement was the fence. It was preventing overgrazing. The pastoralists had developed that practice over centuries of interacting with a fragile ecosystem, and the economists tore it down because it looked irrational from the outside.
That's a perfect example, and it's not an argument against all intervention. It's an argument against intervention that doesn't first ask, why is this here? The pastoralists weren't being romantic traditionalists. They were solving a real problem with the tools they had, and their solution contained knowledge that the economists didn't possess.
Which brings us to the practical cases, because theory is one thing, but does this framework actually deliver innovation in the real world?
Let's take the Green Revolution. Norman Borlaug, working in Mexico in the 1940s and 50s, breeding wheat varieties that were shorter, sturdier, higher yielding. This wasn't a top-down program designed in a Washington conference room. It was incremental, local, responsive. Borlaug spent years crossing thousands of wheat varieties, testing them in different conditions, failing constantly, learning from each failure. He wasn't executing a blueprint. He was discovering what worked.
The scale of the impact is hard to wrap your head around. An estimated 1 billion lives saved from famine.
And it happened through a process that was deeply conservative in its methodology. Small steps, building on existing knowledge, tested against reality at every stage. It wasn't revolutionary. It was evolutionary. But the outcome was revolutionary. That's the conservative innovation paradox. The most transformative changes often come from the most incremental processes.
Let's talk about that paradox directly, because I think it's the strongest argument in the conservative arsenal. The societies that preserve institutional stability actually create better conditions for long-term innovation.
Francis Fukuyama has written about this, the idea of getting to Denmark. Denmark isn't exciting. Denmark doesn't have moonshots. but Denmark has reliable courts, low corruption, secure property rights, and a stable regulatory environment. And those things turn out to be preconditions for sustained innovation. You can't build the tech sector if contracts aren't enforceable. You can't attract investment if the government might seize your assets next week. The boring stuff enables the exciting stuff.
The progressive framework often treats the boring stuff as an obstacle. The regulations are always too slow. The institutions are always too cautious. The process is always too deliberate. But when you strip all that away, you don't get faster innovation, you get chaos, and then you get a strong man who promises to restore order.
China Post 1978 is actually a fascinating case here. Deng Xiaoping's reforms were the largest economic transformation in human history. They lifted hundreds of millions out of poverty. And Deng's guiding metaphor was crossing the river by feeling the stones. That's a deeply conservative approach to radical change. He didn't have a blueprint for market socialism. He created special economic zones, tested reforms locally, watched what happened, and scaled what worked.
Which is intimation in action. You're not designing the perfect system. You're probing, testing, learning, adjusting.
The contrast with the Soviet Union is instructive. The Soviets had a blueprint. They executed it comprehensively, and they stagnated. China felt its way forward, one stone at a time, and became an economic superpower. Now, I'm not endorsing the Chinese political system, far from it, but the economic methodology was conservative in a way that actually worked.
Deng's approach had another conservative feature that's worth highlighting. He didn't start with the hardest problems. He started with agriculture, where the gains were easiest and most visible. Give farmers more control over their plots. Let them sell surplus at market prices. And productivity skyrockets. That early success built legitimacy for the harder reforms that followed. It's a very Burkean sequence. Reform the thing that's already showing signs of strain, prove that reform works, and then use that momentum to tackle the next thing.
Compare that to Gorbachev's perestroika, which tried to reform the entire Soviet system simultaneously. Political structures, economic structures, media, everything at once, and the whole thing collapsed under its own weight. It's not that the Soviet Union didn't need reform. It's the comprehensive reform is almost impossible to execute without breaking the system you're trying to improve.
Let's pressure test this framework, because no framework is complete unless you know where it breaks. Climate change seems like the obvious challenge. If the problem requires rapid, coordinated, system-wide transformation, does incrementalism still work?
This is where the conservative tradition is stressed, and you see different responses. Some conservatives simply deny the problem, which is not a serious answer, but there's a more interesting conservative environmentalism emerging. Thinkers like Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger, they call themselves eco-pragmatists, argue that the standard progressive approach of regulatory restriction and lifestyle sacrifice is doomed. People won't accept lower living standards, and democratic governments can't impose them.
What's the alternative?
Invest massively in technological innovation. Nuclear power, advanced geothermal, carbon capture, even geoengineering research. Make clean energy so cheap and abundant that the market switches to it naturally. That's a conservative approach. It works with human nature rather than against it. It relies on discovery rather than command. And it doesn't require tearing down existing institutions.
The progressive retort would be, that's too slow. We don't have 50 years for nuclear innovation to pan out. We need emissions cuts now.
That's a real tension. The conservative framework is strongest when problems unfold over decades, allowing for experimentation and course correction. It's weaker when problems demand immediate, coordinated action. Pandemic response is another example. You can't feel the stones when the river is rising fast.
Though even there, the conservative instinct to question centralized expertise has its uses. Operation Warp Speed, which was the Trump administration's vaccine development program, was actually a conservative approach to a crisis. Set a clear goal, remove regulatory barriers, let multiple companies compete to solve the problem, and get out of the way. It wasn't incremental, but it was discovery-oriented rather than design-oriented.
That's a fair point. The framework isn't always slow. It's always skeptical of comprehensive blueprints, but it can move fast when it's enabling competition rather than directing outcomes. The distinction is between a government that says, we need a vaccine, here's funding, go compete, and a government that says, we will now reorganize the entire healthcare system according to this 5-year plan.
I think there's a nuance here worth drawing out. Warp speed wasn't laissez-faire. The government spent $18 billion. It coordinated clinical trials, it pre-purchased doses, it helped with manufacturing, but it didn't design the vaccines. It created conditions where multiple teams could try different approaches, mRNA, viral vector, protein subunit, and then scaled the ones that worked. That's the conservative sweet spot. The state as enabling infrastructure, not a central designer.
Which is a much more sophisticated position than government should do nothing, and it's one that the conservative tradition can actually support. Burke wasn't an anarchist. He believed in strong institutions. He just believed they should evolve rather than being rebuilt from scratch.
Let's bring this down to something listeners can actually use. When you're evaluating a proposed change, whether it's a policy, a workplace reorganization, a new technology, what's the conservative lens?
First question, is this a discovery innovation or a design innovation? Is someone testing what works or imposing a blueprint? The conservative move is to be skeptical of the blueprint, not because change is bad, but because blueprints are always simpler than reality.
Second question, what existing knowledge or institutions are being discarded? If the proposal starts with, we need to fundamentally rethink X, the conservative instinct should be, what works about X right now? What would we lose if we threw it out? That's not obstructionism. That's due diligence.
Third question. Can this change be tested locally before it's scaled universally? Deng's special economic zones, Borlaug's test plots, the way software companies roll out features to small user groups before everyone gets them. That's the conservative methodology in action. Small experiments, careful observation, gradual scaling.
The most successful platforms in tech history actually followed this model. Linux wasn't designed from scratch by a committee. It was Linus Torvalds scratching his own itch, sharing the code, and letting thousands of developers improve it organically. The web wasn't a planned system. It was Tim Berners-Lee solving a document sharing problem at CERN, and then it evolved.
Compare that to something like Google Wave, which was a brilliantly designed product that nobody asked for and nobody knew how to use. Designed from first principles, launched comprehensively, failed completely. The market is a discovery procedure, and so is the open source community, and so is any system where people can try things and see what sticks.
I want to add a fourth question to our list, because I think it's implicit in everything we've said, but worth making explicit. What happens if this change fails? In a discovery model, a failed experiment is contained. Borlaug's failed wheat crosses didn't cause a famine. They just got crossed off the list. A failed special economic zone doesn't crash the national economy. But a failed comprehensive reform can be catastrophic. The French Revolution didn't just fail to build a rational society. It produced the Terror, then Napoleon, then a quarter century of continental war. The downside risk of design innovation is systematically higher because the bet is bigger.
That's a crucial point, and it's why the conservative instinct is to prefer reversibility. Small experiments can be walked back. Big blueprints create path dependency. Once you've torn down the old institutions, you can't just put them back. The knowledge that was embedded in them is gone. You're stuck with whatever you built to replace them, even if it's worse.
The deepest division between left and right may not be about whether to change. It's about what kind of change is legitimate. Is legitimacy conferred by the elegance of the plan or by the testing of reality?
That's not a question with an easy answer in every case. There are times when reality is testing us in ways that demand rapid response. But the conservative insight is that most of the time, most of the problems we face are not emergencies. They're persistent challenges that reward patience, experimentation, and respect for accumulated knowledge. The progressive temptation is to treat every problem as a crisis requiring immediate, comprehensive action. The conservative discipline is to ask whether that's actually true.
The other thing the conservative framework does is it forces you to take responsibility for the unintended consequences of your reforms. If you're going to change something, you need to watch what happens and adjust. You don't get to declare victory and move on to the next crusade. The Burkean reformer stays with the reform, watches it play out in practice, and corrects course when reality pushes back.
Which is exhausting and politically unrewarding and doesn't make for good slogans. We will carefully adjust this policy in response to emerging evidence. Doesn't fit on a protest sign. But it's how durable progress actually happens.
There's a deeper point here about the relationship between reform and attention. The progressive model often seems to assume that once the right policy is passed, the work is done. The conservative model assumes that the work is never done, that every reform creates new problems that will require new adjustments, and that the real skill isn't designing perfect systems, but maintaining the capacity to keep improving imperfect ones.
That's Oakeshott's ship again. You never arrive. You just keep it seaworthy. And that's not a failure, it's the human condition.
The open question we should leave listeners with, and this is the one Daniel's prompt ultimately points toward, is whether conservative innovation theory can handle the problems that do require rapid, system-wide transformation. Climate change is the big one. A future pandemic. A cyber attack on critical infrastructure. Are there emergencies where incrementalism fails? And if so, what does a conservative emergency response look like?
I think the answer is that conservative emergency response looks like warp speed, clear goals, competitive discovery, temporary extraordinary measures that sunset when the crisis passes. The key is that the emergency powers don't become permanent. The conservative fear is always that crisis becomes a pretext for permanent centralization, and that fear is not unfounded.
It's the old line, nothing is so permanent as a temporary government program, and we've seen that play out repeatedly. Emergency powers enacted during wars or financial crises that just never go away. The conservative instinct to put sunset clauses on emergency measures isn't paranoia. It's pattern recognition.
The pattern is consistent across centuries. Burke saw it in the aftermath of the Glorious Revolution. Hayek saw it in the wartime economies of Europe. We're seeing it now in the expansion of surveillance powers and executive authority that followed 9/11 and the pandemic. Crisis centralization is a ratchet. It only moves in one direction unless someone actively pushes back.
The final thought is this. The progressive monopoly on the idea of progress is worth challenging, not because progress is bad, but because the progressive definition of progress is too narrow. It assumes that change is always forward motion, that new is always better, that the past is mostly a collection of errors to be corrected. The conservative tradition offers a different account, one where progress is real but fragile, where institutions embody wisdom we should be slow to discard, and where the most durable advances come from discovery, not design. That's not an argument against change. It's an argument for a particular kind of change, and it deserves to be taken seriously, not dismissed as mere obstruction.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1927, a beekeeper in Hokkaido recorded a single season yield of 112 kilograms of lavender honey from just 8 hives, roughly 14 kilograms per hive, which is about 3 times the modern commercial average for monofloral honey production in temperate climates.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own question or challenge our entire political framework, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
And Korn. We'll be back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.